When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
I'm Vijay Vaidyaswaran. I'm the Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor at The Economist.
How many COPs do you think you've covered at this point?
Too many is the answer. there's no good number to cover.
COP stands for Conference of the Parties. It's the UN's annual summit on climate change. This year's COP in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, is the 27th one.
The most memorable one probably was in The Hague in the Netherlands a couple of decades ago when I was standing near Frank Lloyd, the U.S. negotiator who had a pie thrown in his face. And I can still taste the custard.
Vijay argues that not all COPs are created equal. There are big ones and there are little ones.
So every 5 years or so is a big COP, meaning there's something quite substantial on the agenda, a major breakthrough. We can think about the Paris Accord, which was reached, of course, in France. That was a big COP. There was a lot that people had to negotiate for. And then a number of years went by, and then we had the Glasgow COP. Now, it was a little more than 5 years because of the pandemic, but that's the rhythm of these UN conferences of the parties.
Vijay says that this year's COP, COP 27, is a little COP.
But that doesn't mean that nothing is going to happen. And there is one very explosive issue, which I'm sure we'll talk about, which is reparations.
Climate reparations, what the UN calls loss and damage. That would mean rich countries, big emitters like the United States, would pay developing nations for the damage they've suffered from climate change. Damage they did very little to create. Today on the show, poor countries want to see the money. Vijay says it isn't going to happen, and that asking for reparations is the wrong approach. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
President El-Sisi, thank you very much for this wonderful hospitality.
Apart from your standard diplomatic platitudes, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was not subtle in his opening remarks at COP27.
Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
But climate hell looks different depending where you are on the globe. And going in, everyone pretty much knew what would be on this year's agenda.
If you just look at it from the point of view of, you know, what's realistically achievable, there was a chance that at this particular gathering, we would see the issue of loss and damage, that's UN speak for money that would be paid from rich countries, particularly to the most vulnerable poor countries, in recognition of the fact that rich countries got rich burning fossil fuels by and large and contributed the most to the problem, and that mostly vulnerable countries, especially the island states and some of the very poorest countries, are the ones that are going to suffer the worst damage starting very, very soon and therefore should be compensated, right? That issue had been fought for a very long time by the rich countries, especially the United States, that didn't want to acknowledge it because they were worried about liability, lawsuits. And there was some hope that this might be discussed formally on the agenda. And that's what's happening this time.
The idea of loss and damage, or climate reparations, isn't new. The Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu raised the question of who should pay for damage to their archipelago back in the 1990s. But what's novel, Vijay says, is rich countries allowing discussion of the issue into the carefully choreographed linguistic dance of international negotiations.
On the first day of COP, just as it was starting, there was actually a surprise that the particularly the advanced economies, notably the United States, allowed loss and damage to be formally written into the agenda for discussion, right? Because they had obstructed it. That terminology, especially because it was loaded with the concept of reparations possibly coming through, was one that was blocked historically by Western governments. And this time, it's on there as a point of discussion. Now, that doesn't mean there's going to be any money. That doesn't mean there's going to be any resolution of it at this COP. But now it's officially part of the process. And so that's something. And you can think of it as a, you know, the sort of the thin end of the wedge on this issue.
Yeah, I am fascinated by the, for lack of a better term, glacial pace by which some of this moves. I mean, loss and damage was talked about in Warsaw in 2013 and again in Madrid in 2019. And yet it seemed like this was the big one of sort of having the United States and the EU at least be willing to maybe discuss this.
The idea that rich countries should acknowledge that there was historic contribution to emissions, that poor countries will suffer the brunt of this, and that rich countries should help pay for dealing with these consequences, right? That idea has been around for decades. It's and in the UN discussions has been around, but it has always been resisted in part because there are several questions, right? Some of them related to liability. That is, if particularly the United States acknowledges some sort of culpability, liability, then the lawsuits would never end. We're a litigious society. We already know there are climate lawsuits that are underway and attempts at climate lawsuits around the world. And so there was a great reluctance from American administrations of both stripes, not only one or the other, but really all American administrations have been resistant to that idea for that reason.
John Kerry, the U.S. climate envoy to these talks, dug in his heels when asked about it at the conference.
But it's a well-known fact that the United States and many other countries will not establish some sort of, some sort of a legal structure that is tied to, compensation or liability. That's just not happening.
But there are also other questions raised about what exactly would be the structure of any fund that's created, right? How much money would it be enough? And how would it be spent if it's just an enormous kitty with lots of money that the UN administers? Questions come up about transparency, about corruption, about efficiency. Is this the right way to deal with the problem, right? So it's not just a question of not wanting to say sorry or not wanting to cough up the money. There are other ways of dealing with this as well, through existing multilateral institutions, through bilateral donor aid. I mean, the rich world, especially the US, but certainly European allies and Japan, already give lots of money for funding disaster relief for the WHO, which deals with health emergencies, which will increasingly be related to climate emergencies, for refugee flows through the UN again. And so there are already mechanisms in place. What would a giant new UN fund do that would be really good? If it were done well, that'd be fantastic. But a lot of people have doubts about the UN. Can it really administer a massive fund in a non-corrupt way? Is one of the questions that people ask.
Vijay says he's not skeptical of the moral case for loss and damage, but he questions whether it's at all practical.
I don't think we're going to find a lot of support for a massive loss and damage fund. I certainly agree at this COP. I mean, that's not going to happen, not at this gathering. I think at best, what might happen is some agreement to have a discussions continued at another UN forum going forward. That is this process will wind down for a year or two where we continue to talk about maybe ultimately setting up a fund that has maybe some unknown amount of money. That's sort of how these things work, right? It's a slow walk. I think that's sort of what's going on here. But let's even game it out and say, okay, let's get to the end of that movie. There is a fund. It's set up. Developing countries get what they want. How much money would there be? And the answer is, it's got to be measured in billions, right? That's really what we're talking about, is realistic, if anything will go in there at all. But the scale of dealing with climate change is a problem that has to be measured in trillions of dollars, not billions, right? And so that's where my skepticism comes from, that this UN-administered process of getting apologies from the rich countries and a bunch of money will anyway be commensurate to the actual task, which is immediate humanitarian tragedies happening on a daily, a weekly, and monthly basis going forward. And we need rapid disbursement of aid. We need much more money to deal with that humanitarian crisis response, including probably nimbler ways of getting money, bypassing government bureaucracies through micropayments, for example, and directly to people in affected communities, and engaging them with sort of questions and participation in what they need to rebuild their communities. That's very different than what the UN is good at.
I would like to take a concrete example and sort of puzzle out with you how this stuff works. So let's take Pakistan. It came to this COP really pushing for the idea of a fund. It contributes less than 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions, but it's hugely vulnerable to climate change, as we have sort of horrifyingly seen this year. Where could Pakistan get the money to help? And how do you think that could work in, I guess, the most constructive way?
So I would reframe the question, if you don't mind, and I would say, what is the best way for countries like Pakistan to deal with the ongoing and increasing risk of these sorts of emergencies, right, that are caused by or at a minimum exacerbated by climate change? I mean, let's remember, disasters are a normal and horrible reality for the developing world and have been through all of time, right? Before the Industrial Revolution began, there were disasters in the developing world. And so climate change makes worse things that were already happening, in addition to creating entirely new perils. And so countries need capacity. They need capacity, they need resilience, they need decent policies, they need fairly honest administration of resources. Those are the fertile soils on which seeds need to fall. If you simply pour a bunch of money into a system that doesn't work, a corrupt, cronyistic state, let's say, or one that has very little community outreach, local adaptation capability, then you're not going to have the effect that you want. You might side off, say, yes, we're sorry, here's a bunch of money. But the people who are affected may not get those resources in the way they need them to adapt.
Right. But people should not be punished for the ineptitude or the corruption of their government. So how then does an international community create those opportunities for resilience, for change that are, you know, accountable or transparent?
You're right. People should not be punished for the incompetence or venality of their governments, but this is a regular occurrence throughout the world, right? This is the state of how things are. So in an imperfect world, how do we move forward? One way is to think about the UN process, and there are things that the UN does very well. UNICEF, for example, is an excellent organization. Vaccinations, for example, is an example where we see a phenomenal interventions by an official body, an organized UN approach, where we're very, very good at vaccinating poor children in the developing world, right? That's something that works. And can we maybe learn from that, cut and paste in other areas of disaster relief? But there's also a huge amount of philanthropic intervention. You see, at this COP, the Gates Foundation announced a huge $1.4 billion for adaptation funding. It's one of the biggest contributions to that area. And again, adaptation is very close to loss and damage. Now, technically, it's a different bucket, right?
Yeah, can adaptation... you translate some UN into English for me? So mitigation and adaptation are the phrases that get thrown around in normal person speak. What is that?
Stop emitting greenhouse gases. That, you know, reducing the amount of coal we burn and just generally dealing with the causing the problem in the first place, that's called mitigation in UN speak, right? The meaning, how do we transition to a clean energy economy, for example, or deal with methane emissions from rice paddies and flatulent cows and that sort of thing, right? So dealing with emissions in the first place that cause the problem is mitigation. Now, adaptation is the next bucket, which used to be seen as sort of a dirty word by some in the activist community, because if you say, well, if you're going to invest in adaptation, you've already given up. You know, you're not going to try to shut down big oil. You're saying just live with the consequences of climate change. Well, those days are gone now, right? We're already in a world of severe climate impacts. And unfortunately, because of that ideological opposition to dealing with adaptation, we lost a couple of decades, in my view.
Vijay argues that developed economies can help vulnerable countries now by spending money on adapting to climate change, following the lead of a number of philanthropies.
The Gates Foundation as well has announced money, in addition to the Rockefeller, and other philanthropic organizations are spending a lot on helping smallholder farmers, for example, in Africa. They face a double bind. There's going to be droughts. That's going to mean their crops are going to be need to be drought resistant. But at the same time, they're also going to have freakish storms. And so they're going to have prolonged periods of excess water. Now, how do you develop strains of the kinds of crops that they use, cassava and others in sub-Saharan Africa, that are able to handle both kinds of stress, right? That's the kind of challenge that these foundations are putting money into with the UN system of agricultural research that helped develop the first green revolution, which really saved a billion lives 5 decades ago. That system of agricultural research stations is getting funding from philanthropy as well as through the UN. Those are the kinds of things that may be unglamorous. They're kind of in the weeds and bottom up, but that actually make a difference. And that's, I think, where there is progress away from the headlines and away from the rancor of some of the politics of the UN process. We're actually seeing more, and we need to double down and quadruple down on those kinds of investments on the ground, building capacity, right? It's when you build that capacity, it actually helps the local governments in those areas, whatever the national politics, they can see the benefits in the community.
When we come back, is ignoring poor countries' requests for reparations a kind of climate colonialism?
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I sort of hear you describing a two-track thing where maybe at the COP there are the press conferences and the big negotiations and sort of whatever grabs headlines, and then the unofficial stuff that's happening on the sidelines, whether that is, you know, under the umbrella of the UN or under the umbrella of philanthropy. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And not only those categories, but we see the private sector stepping up as well. We're seeing a number of corporates making commitments. Big corporates from around the world are promising to purchase green products before they're economic, right? For example, green cement was announced at this year's COP, but previously there had been other categories that had been announced at last year's COP or at gatherings like the Davos World Economic Forum, confab, where these fat cats like to get together. But, you know, to give them their due, being willing to pay above the odds for the first batch of green cement, let's say cement that's made in a way that's less greenhouse gas intensive, it costs a lot. And you're not going to just pay for it, in the marketplace. The market wouldn't justify that kind of premium. But these big companies are offering to pay more for it and thereby bringing in the market. It's like the rich and green Silicon Valley folks who bought the first Tesla Roadster for $125,000, $150,000, they helped buy down the cost so that ultimately Tesla could be acquired for, much less money, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, and ultimately bring it down the cost. And that's what typically happens with the the first product, and that's a good thing.
I guess to push you on this a little bit, though, there is something about that that feels, I don't know, almost colonialist. You know, you have a number of coalitions of countries from the global south coming to these conferences saying, listen to us, this is the thing we want, and having big countries, rich countries who have historically emitted a lot, say, no, here is this other option. You know, how do you get past what feels like a very different mindset from each group?
So let's take that up, right at the heart of the colonialist. Colonialism is a particular word, represents a certain kind of resource extraction. But I think the gist of it, what I'm picking up, is a moral argument, right?
That is a culpability.
The rich world got rich burning fossil fuels, and now they're trying to keep us poor, or they're not helping us deal with the consequences of that legacy greenhouse gases that's in the atmosphere, where, as in the case of Africa, which contributed hardly 3% of the global stock of greenhouse gases, will probably be the continent that suffers the worst impacts from climate, right? There's no more compelling case than that to support this moral argument. And so I think the moral case is very strong, and that's why the rich world has to contribute much more. My question is, what mechanisms, what are the ways to do this, right? Is an enormous facility, as they're called, the financial fund managed by the United Nations, is that the right amount of money? Is that the right mechanism to do this? I think reasonable people can agree on the morality of it and disagree on the mechanisms, questioning the efficacy of such a fund, right? And there's also some challenges that are put forward on the moral case. If we look at Dickinsey in England, where there was a huge amount of coal burned, should that burning of coal in England be held as the same amount of moral culpability as the amount of coal that China burned in the last 20 years?
Because now we know.
First of all, now we know. And also the volume, right? The sheer volume. Back in Dickens's time, we didn't really know. There's no general awareness of the kind of consequences of climate change that would be caused by burning that coal. And the last 20 years, we have known. I wrote a book 20 years ago, Power to the People, that made this case based on the best science at the time, that we had to act on climate and move to a net zero world. And so all of the coal burning in China, as well as other countries, clearly has to have a moral tinge to it. And not only that, today, China is the world's largest emitter, and its number of coal plants they are currently building and bringing online in the next 10 years, it continues apace, right? They knowingly they're building and these plants and emitting. Now, where's China at the table on this, right? So developing countries have actually said during this COP, China should be included. It's not just US and Europe. But then the politics of the UN are so fractious, they said, oh, by the way, India too. The island states are demanding that India also pays, that India accepts responsibility and India also pays. And guess what? India will never pay. India still thinks itself as a victim on the global stage. That's the card they play on the world stage. And so in a sense, the politics are poisoned by that choice by those developing countries to demand this. That's why I say this particular format and forum is a talking shop and there's a lot of posturing going on. I'm a practical person. I say, look, the problems are too severe to leave to the talking shop. Let's find other ways to dramatically increase the funding. There may be a small fund set up. That's great. It'll never be enough for the task. So I think there are lots of things we can do that go beyond just setting up a UN facility, which is fine. I have no problem with that, but I think that'll be a palliative. I don't think it'll solve the problem.
I mean, speaking of China, you know, Pakistan owes about 30% of its debt to China. If they wanted to, they could just give them a big haircut and give them a lot more money for climate change. But I think you and I would probably agree that's not going to happen.
I think the question of developing world debt is not just China, of course. There's a huge problem, an overhang of debt in the developing world. And if new kinds of assistance to help the developing countries develop their clean energy is done through debt instruments in a world of high interest rates and a world of inflation that we're entering, possibly a global recession, I think we're going to see a massive debt crisis that's exploding. Yeah. So I think we need to really rethink that paradigm whereby we consider this to be the rich countries, including China in this group now, are peddling ever more debt. Even if it's on concessional terms, it's still a millstone around the neck of developing countries, that especially the poorest, that cannot afford to service it.
There was an international climate agreement this week that Vijay thinks could be a model for future ones. It's the JETP, the Just Energy Transition Partnership, that came out of the G20 meeting in Indonesia. It's a fund through which Indonesia will get $20 billion, some from rich countries, some from the private sector, to transition away from coal.
And so the basic idea is that this amount of funding will basically pay off coal plants to retire early, because otherwise they'd be spewing out vast amounts of greenhouse gases for the next 30, 40 years, and help fund clean energy, replacing that energy from coal. That's the concept. And I think it's a really good concept, because if we do nothing, the amount of coal that's going to be burnt in China, India, in Indonesia, and South Africa alone will mean we'll blow past any attempts to keep climate change within even not just the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, which is we're already well beyond that now on our trajectory, but well beyond the 2 degree target also, which is will still be very painful. If we go past that, it's going to be a really hellish world that we're going to head towards. Coal is the number one problem at the moment, I think, and in particular in Asian countries, because that's where the coal is. And of course, South Africa as well, as a big polluter, can be in that group. This kind of deal, they call it a Just Energy Transition Partnership, or JETP in the jargon. South Africa got a deal like this last year at last year's COP. It was worth about $8.5 billion. Indonesia is a much bigger polluter and a much harder problem in terms of the coal mafias and the power of coal elites in that country. And so it's really interesting and innovative to try to tackle this problem by bringing in fresh capital, basically to bribe the coal companies and those investors in coal who have a legitimate legal reason to see their assets run a useful life. You say, hey, we're going to pay you more to wind down your dirty business. And that way you create room in the marketplace for what will be subsidized clean energy. I think it's a very interesting experiment. I wish it luck. I hope it succeeds.
Coming out of this COP, and I guess kind of watching all the various developments, as someone who's covered a lot of these, do you feel hopeful I guess I sort of wonder how you are feeling about what you saw and what you didn't see.
If you only look at what the UN is doing, you would bang your head against a wall, right? It's a very, very frustrating process. Yeah, because you have to get all 200 plus countries to agree, and it's impossible to get them all to agree on anything, or it's very difficult anyway, right? And so it's almost set up to fail, the UN process, because of any one country can veto the entire process. And we saw this last year at Glasgow, where there was nearly a consensus to phase out coal. That would have been a huge breakthrough. But at the last minute, the delegate from India put up a veto. And so the group, which was almost ready there to phase out coal as an agreement, a official UN agreed sort of language, we're going to phase down coal was the compromise. Now, what the heck does that mean, phase down coal? It's meaningless, right? It's UN babble for really with no targets, no timetables, no money, no nothing. So that's the kind of thing that could happen with one country. So the way I look at it is I say, look, you have to look at this like we saw the nuclear arms talks between the USSR and the US during the Cold War, or the trade discussions at the GATT, which was the precursor to the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Every year, for year after year, decade after decade, negotiators would meet and they'd try to make progress on different issues. And a lot of times they'd go home empty-handed. Sometimes the talks would collapse. But every once in a while, when the timing was right, when self-interest aligned, they'd have a breakthrough. And that talking shop kept, in the case of the nuclear talks, it kept us from having a global Armageddon. And we ultimately did reduce the level of danger to the point where we could get to a Cold War that was not a hot war. In the case of GATT, we did create the World Trade Organization, and we had a phenomenal golden age of globalization. For all of its flaws, did help lift up probably a couple of billion people out of the direst poverty, and they were the great beneficiaries of globalization. And so there were things that were achieved. But at the same time, any given negotiation like this year's COP could be quite frustrating. It could yet end in tears on Saturday, we'll have to see, or it may have just minor breakthroughs. At the same time, the real action happens from the bottom up, on the side, at the periphery, through coalitions of the willing. That's where I find my optimism.
Do we have time for that as a planet?
Well, the planet's going to be fine. It's a question of, does humanity have time, right? And the answer is no, we don't have time. We needed to have acted a couple of decades ago when people began to sound the alarm, and we did not, right? We have failed. There's no other way to put it. There's no simpler way to put it. Now, the question is, given the state of the world and the world we live in, how do we mobilize our resources? How do we dramatically increase climate ambition? And at the same time, bring along those that are going to be losers. Look, among the obstructionists are the Middle Eastern oil company countries, right? The Saudi Arabia and its ilk and OPEC, who they're going to be last man standing producing oil, right? So they often object behind the scenes and play a spoiler's role. They're the developing countries. In this COP in Africa, we had a number of African countries point out the hypocrisy of Europe guzzling the world's natural gas in the form of liquefied natural gas, LNG imports, so they can keep its lights on during its crisis, raising prices for the poor world to get that gas and stopping African countries from developing their own gas. Europe has objected and put up obstacles. And they say, look, you know, you developed and got rich, and now you're keeping us from developing using our resources. That's hypocrisy. And so you see, it's a little more complicated than just, well, the plan is clear. Why don't we just act on it? Different people have different points of view on what the plan should be.
Vijay Vaithyaswaran, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Vijay Vaithyaswaran is the Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor at The Economist. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. We are edited by Tori Bosch. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next, and Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we're also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And if you are a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Join Slate Plus. If you become a member, you get all your Slate podcasts with no ads. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. All right, we'll be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.